smartphone, DSTV Channel 856 and on 92.7 and 106 FM.
This is 702.
We're talking books with literary journalist Ms. Karabo Kholeng. Good morning, Karabo. It's such a pleasure to speak to you, as always.
Always a pleasure, Rifile. This is also one of my favorite times of the week. It's like, oh,
girl, you bring out the Oprah in me.
About the things that we love.
You bring out the Oprah in me. I get all sing-songy all of a sudden. Hmm? What Korobela are you using?
Just spreading the love for books, you know, and story. I think that's the one thing that can keep us safe, is also the capacity to imagine ourselves beyond this moment.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's hard to do so when you feel it so keenly, and you feel as though, you know, this is the be all and end all, and yet there is, you know, there is a future.
There is definitely a future, and there are also psychologists who are offering services at lower rates online.
Beautiful, yeah.
And people must speak to their employers. I know that if you're on medical aid, you do qualify for a certain amount of therapy. Just get the help you need. What's beautiful is that those who are being called to heal are actually really going out of their way to see us all through this. So also big love to them as well.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So today's book is a very interesting one, an industry that is really at pains at this point. It's called Tobacco Wars by Talita Snikers. Tell us more about it.
Hey, if fear of dying from cigarettes is not enough to make you quit,
you say, hey. Mm-hmm.
This book, when you realize how big it is, because, you know, I'd come across Johan van Logelberg's work because, you know, he was an investigative journalist and tax investigator. And for me, Johan and Talita are like the Andrew Feinsteins. You know, Andrew Feinstein, he looked at the arms deal and what it was causing, and he looked at the whole global arms trade. And basically, this is what they've done. And Talita worked herself, she also worked at SARS.
Yeah.
And then she went on to travel around and work in 25 countries on tax and customs modernization initiatives. And like I say, you know, she and Van Logelberg, for me, they're like the Feinsteins of big tobacco, because you're... they're coming for them, hey? Yeah. And when you start to understand why tobacco is so problematic, apart from the fact that it kills more than half of its users,
yeah,
is to look at the history and understand the nuances. So now I'm starting to, you know, reflect on the tobacco ban, you know, in COVID. Unfortunately, yes, you know, we have to be so careful of, you know, politicizing a disease, right?
Sure.
And the thing is, it's murky. It's all smoke, pun intended, when it comes to the tobacco industry, right? Mm. So what she does is she gives you the historical background, which I love. I love a good story. And how tobacco became so ubiquitous and how big tobacco has managed to evade tax. Mm-hmm. And does not take responsibility for its supply chain by saying, well, our cigarettes just disappear. And Talita's like, but honey, a toothpaste can be traced, you know, from the user to the source.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody gets sick from eating a can of fish, that can be traced back to its farmer in a village,
mm-hmm.
Like halfway across the world. You mean to tell me that with the kind of money that big tobacco has, that they're not taking responsibility for their supply chain? Well, you know why it's that? Because 98% of all illicit cigarettes come from legal licensed manufacturers.
Mm.
It is in big tobacco's interest to evade tax. So it's their own cigarettes that end up becoming illicit. And they say, well, someone smuggled them. But they refuse to use the same technologies to track their product,
sure.
You know, as other fast moving consumer goods do, you know. And So she starts with sort of giving a background to the history of like how BAT started and film arts. And it's actually a fascinating story. And then you also realize it's another thing of like big boys who actually don't care about people. They care about money, right? So in the beginning, she writes about these two folks and, and how, you know, cigarettes used to be rolled by cigarette girls.
Sure.
And then the one invented a machine, and they realized that they were making more cigarettes than they could sell. So they decided to go on a massive, massive marketing campaign. You know, the same way that De Beers did with diamonds. Exactly the same way, where people did not feel the need to consume this product, but they went on to do it. And the irony is that the big tobacco started a tobacco research institute in the 70s when the surgeons around the world were starting to say, your product is killing people and you're lying about it and you admit to lying about it.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, no. So
I'm going to stop you right there. And in that regard, if you want to consume some more content about the tobacco industry and cigarettes as entertainment, a beautiful movie that sort of that paints the picture of that period of time that you're talking about, Karabo, is Thank You for Smoking, starring Aaron Eckhart and Cameron Bright. It's incredibly dark and quirky and interesting and gripping comedy. But yeah, that's the tobacco industry if you want to consume more about them as a form of entertainment. But you know, it's so what you're telling me about this specific book is it's quite wide-ranging. It takes you, like you said, to the very beginning. And how is Talita able to, you know, how, what kind of language is she employing? Is it all dry historical black and white, or is she weaving this as a sort of narrative of journalism that, you know, unpacks themes that that makes the characters live, you know, and makes the companies and the various individuals or players characters within the story?
Oh, honey, she spills the tea. You know, you have to pause and be like, wait, this is actually happening. But she doesn't do it in a sensationalist way, because you can't make this stuff up.
Okay.
You know? So, you know, she really does come with the facts. And, you know, just to see the enormity of things. So the numbers are really big, but then she says, you know, I'm just showing why the numbers are this big and that they get away with it. Because they also corrupt governments, you know? And, you know, the thing is, basically, for me, it reads like there's no such thing as legal big tobacco, because it is so tainted from the beginning, from its origins to how it's operating today, where, you know, it's the Italian mafia that is involved in running the supply of Marlboros. And you look at, you know, the involvement, she's writing about the Chinese tobacco industry is a whole book on its own. You know, she touches on it a little bit. But the thing is also, these are dangerous people, because even Van Loggenberg in his book had said that, you know, these guys are, you know, it's bank robbers, it's muggers, and it's bag snatchers, right across the board, including the ones who are so-called legal, because they evade tax. So they purposefully allow their cigarettes to become illicit. And you know what they did that was very clever? When the smaller manufacturers came in, because now you could buy a cigarette manufacturing machine from China and then make your own cigarettes, like the Yusuf Kadis did in South Africa, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what Big Tobacco did is that they marketed the cheaper cigarettes as the criminals. They pointed at them, And the fact that, you know, it's the cheaper cigarettes that make their way into prisons and stuff. So they actually scapegoating the smaller manufacturers who are not evading tax to the extent that Big Tobacco has been evading tax. And some of these big tobacco companies, I mean, their head offices are based in Lausanne, of all places. It's one of the best places to hide your financial secrets, right?
Sure.
And some of them also have interest in big food. They're second only to Nestle.
So, you know, what I'm keen to find out, Karabo, is there surely there's no way that an author, an investigator can write about, as you said, a dangerous and shadowy industry, and then not tell us about her own process? Because in some ways, you know, you've just said you can't make this stuff up. And one imagines then that she has to include at some point elements of, first of all, how she's researched it. Secondly, what precautions she took whilst writing all of this, whilst investigating all of this. And of course, post-publication, because I don't know, is it dangerous enough for her to be paranoid and to be nervous about her her safety and her bodily integrity? Or, you know, does that come up in any way in the book? Does she address that? Because I'm that nosy reader that now wants to know everything. You know, you can't leave me hanging and just give me your research.
Well, look, you know what? Because these people worked in tax investigations and stuff to do with arms, you're talking with big money, you're talking multinationals, whose financial arm is stronger than the countries whose laws they violate.
Mm.
You know, so as investigative writers, as tax investigators, I am sure that there are security protocols that and threats that she's been through that I don't think it would be in anyone's interest for her to write about. In the same way that, you know, Feinstein speaks, he writes in the same manner when, you know, talks about arms dealers and, you know, and meeting them and stuff like that, because you don't want to give away your entire game.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And also I can imagine that some of the information is also, you know, it's fragile because you're talking about state security across multinational states.
Mm.
You know, so sometimes you have to be as murky in terms of how you reveal your information, you know, in terms of being exact. The fact that, you know, she got all the dockets, she was given a USB drive in Rosebank that leaked all kinds of information, and it was from somebody, you know, who was in big tobacco, you know. So, you know, and the fact is that her work is verifiable because she's been covering this. And looking at ways in which, especially more vulnerable economies, can strengthen their tax regimes, right?
Exactly.
And their tax systems and make them modern so that,
sure.
Yeah, so that they can collect. And we know that SARS used to be one of the top ones in the world, right?
Sure.
And then when you look at how it can be, basically, this is another lesson on how large multinationals, there needs to be a different way to govern them.
Mm.
And that it requires international kind of solidarity, right, where you can't have these tax havens that will agree to keep secrets, knowing that they're keeping financial secrets from people who are making money off taking human rights and human life away.
Yeah. I mean, that's such an interesting element that you bring up, Garabo, especially now in this current context. This book was published in June of this year, right? And in this current context, we sit in a position where the United States, the biggest donor to the WHO has essentially put in formal notification to say, listen, we're pulling out of the World Health Organization, this global body, which is meant to help everybody deal with the pandemic that we're currently, you know, in the midst of, you know, in the thrall of right now. We see a U.S. that has essentially abdicated its self-proclaimed and self-appointed responsibility to essentially be the big brother of the world, and in many ways lead these big global bodies, which in many ways coordinated the kind of global coordination, the kind of global participation, these global regimes that we've come to know and which have been helpful in many regards. So when you point to the need for this kind of global coordination and agreement and transparency, my goodness, you're really putting up a huge challenge for states.
Yes, and you know, to add to your point, not only does the U.S. decide they want to, you know, stop investing in WHO, they buy up all the drugs.
Mm. Sure.
You know, I mean, like that they buy up all the drugs. Mm. So, which means that now, how then you have to borrow money to buy meds from the U.S. Like, and this is a global human life crisis. Mm. Like, you know, and the thing is, you see, we're in a very interesting moment in terms of, you know, global politics, right? Because there's still this paradigm shift that needs to happen at at the location of leadership, right? Mm. Where you have to walk the talk. You know, you can't tell us about human rights while you violate it. And then, you know, I'll give you another example, right? So, like, multinationals, especially, like, you know, in the arms trade, in the food trade, right? But particularly in the arms trade, they can bribe African governments into buying weapons that they don't need, which is exactly what happened in South Africa. But we can't go and sue them in their countries. They write it in their ledger, in their ledger as incidental. So I can't go and sue a company in France or in Britain, you know, for being in a corrupt relationship with my government.
Sure.
You know, and that's why the thing between states and big money and multinational money, that now it's capital has become the ultimate sovereign, where nation states actually, they don't have that power anymore. And when they do, they're bought.
Sure.
So, I mean, and how do you hold them to account? Because that's the thing. We have these stories, and I think that's what a lot of, especially political scientists and social scientists and philosophers and people in law and stuff, you know, that's the question that we're currently sitting with. Like, how do you put those checks and balances in place? Because also, sovereign states have a right to decide to allow the businesses that operate from within to do what they want. Let me give you another example. Amazon. Amazon does not pay tax in the U.S., it's wild, right?
Yeah.
You buy their products.
So, you know, Karabo, this is, I'm looking at the clock right now and our time is running out, unfortunately. And Amazon can be a conversation for another day when you look at the money that its owner, George Bezos, has made just during this global pandemic, right? With people moving online and living their lives and shopping online and do everything online. That's a whole nother conversation. When you finish reading this book and you're ready to put it down, what is the key takeaway? Do you want to become a hermit and move away and go live on some cliff face somewhere whilst you just meditate for the rest of your days and, you know, imbibe only oxygen and water? What does it do to you?
It just makes me want to spend more wisely. You know, like, know where my stuff is coming from.
Sure.
So that I don't, and I know we feel powerless as consumers, but that's how we make them powerful. You know? And it's hard work because, yes, but like in terms of supply chain, that's why these things are important, right?
Sure.
So that you know why it's not a good idea to eat a product made by a particular company, why it's important to try and make your things as local as possible. Right? And that's the thing with the pandemic. So, you know, if it means, like, to, you know what you were saying when you were speaking to the restaurants, like, if I order in from my favorite restaurants and I actually donate to COVID relief for them, you know, so we need to become more mindful of our consumption. That's the only way. I mean, look, we can't take down the whole man, but I think just for you to rest, just to know that the things that you break your back working so hard and sweating for, you don't feed it back into something that is robbing other people of dignity and life. And that's all we can do. Because, I mean, we don't have land to go and meditate at. And that's a whole other story. You know, it belongs to big corporations. But that's all you can do. Just be more mindful of where you put your money.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I think we feel a webinar on how to become a supply chain detective coming up, organized, hosted by Ms. Karabo Kholeng. And I joke, but I don't joke. I understand and I feel you. My goodness, adulting is tough, Karabo. It is tough. Let me give you a spot of good news. I don't know if you've heard already.
Before you do, let me tell you, right?
Yeah.
One of our listeners actually sent me a Dambuzo Marichera, like, collection.
What? Girl,
yeah.
What?
Like, we heard you.
The entire collection. That is beautiful.
We're going to hold you to it. So you can't complain and say you couldn't get access to the book. And they sent them to me.
That is beautiful. Okay, fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, so Dambuzo Marichera, here we come with a little festival and a celebration of you and your works. I'm looking forward to Karabo. Another thing is one of your favorite writers has picked herself up another accolade, Bernardine Evaristo, becoming you know, those first titles, becoming the first black writer to win Author of the Year with the British Book Awards. And I'm here for collecting all those bags and snatching them up. Lovely.
Who won?
Bernardine Evaristo.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That is really wonderful.
I mean, they should have just given her the Booker alone. We love Atwood, but they should have just given it to her alone. Like, look, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. We're here for all of that.
For the book Girl, Woman, Other.
Getting a place in the... Yes.
Yeah.
Getting our place in the sun.
All right. Fantastic. Karabo, you and I will chat again next week, Saturday. Always a pleasure rounding off the show with you. Have a good one.
Pleasure was all mine, Lucille.
All right.